Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm your host, Travis, and today we're going to delve into the five big costs of bad student loan policy. It's very clear that student loans are broken in this country. It doesn't take a genius to figure out why. A lot of different repayment plans, massive balances, exploding interest growth, out of control costs of higher education. We could go on and on and on about how much needs to be fixed about the broken student loan system. I will focus today on five different kinds of costs of this bad, broken student loan system and how you might be able to get over these hurdles. The first one I'm going to talk about today is higher inequality. This is kind of interesting because you might think, well, student loans get people a path towards a better life. They get you education, higher earnings, more sort of fulfilling your purpose in life. But what's really interesting is if you look at some research about things like the PSLF waiver that just came out, a group at UVA put this out, and it's a really, really great paper. I would highly encourage you to at least read the abstract. You know, kind of a nerdy thing to say, right? But it basically finds that if the PSLF waiver was fully implemented, it would actually reduce inequality and actually help close the racial wealth gap. Black borrowers are more likely to be in public service. And if you had full implementation of the PSLF waiver, it would actually help shrink some of the unequal outcomes we see in student loans. And unfortunately, what's happening because of the PSLF waiver being super complicated and student loans in general being super complicated is we are seeing disproportionately more advantaged groups with more access to resources get forgiveness and get extra credit towards forgiveness, and less advantaged groups are getting it less. And that's a big problem. So what's probably going to end up happening is the PSLF waiver will certainly help a lot of people, but overall, it's probably going to be a failure. And the reason why that is we only have about $8 or $9 billion of loans that have been forgiven so far. And ultimately, when the waiver expires, we're probably going to have about 15 to maybe best case $20 billion of loans that will have been forgiven. And if we look at the amount of debt that could have been forgiven, it's probably in the neighborhood of $145 billion or more even. A program that brings relief to only 10% of the potential eligible population can't really be viewed as a success, in my book at least. And this is a big problem. If we look at how the loan programs work across different kind of parts of it, for example, being able to borrow in limited sums for grad school through the Grad Plus program. Well, honestly, you know, if you had larger Pell Grants for communities that have lower incomes, that's probably a bigger impact on people. It probably does a better job of getting people upper mobility. Why is that the case? Well, if you have a $400,000 balance from grad school, first of all, it shouldn't have cost that in the first place. But if you do, there's actually a lot of great ways to handle it. We talk about that all the time on this show. Income-driven repayment, refinancing, PSLF, going for 20-year forgiveness if you don't qualify for PSLF, different loopholes with filing taxes separately. If you live in a certain kind of state with community property rules and you're married, you can get payments that are lower. You can save for retirement and lower your adjusted gross income. There are so many different ways that you can get relief if you have $400K of student debt. But what if you are somebody who is the first generation person in your family to go to college and you have $30,000 of student debt and you are in a corporate job making $50K a year and you are the person that's helping out your family with all kinds of bills that are coming up because you're the only person with a college degree in your family? The current student loan system does very little for you. You might get some subsidized loans, which help with the interest, which interest doesn't accrue during school for subsidized loans, but those are very limited in terms of how much you can get out. And so you come out with this $30,000 of debt. You don't really qualify for income-based payments so much because you have $50K of income and maybe no dependents. Maybe you're having to pay that $300 a month standard repayment plan anyway. Meanwhile, if you maybe have $100,000 of income and you're maxing out your 401k and you're filing taxes separately, you might be able to pay less money on a six-figure loan balance than somebody that has a $50K debt could pay on a $30K balance. That is probably not great policy because you're charging more for somebody who earns less than somebody who earns more. That is the problem when you have a complex system like our current student loan system, is there are winners and losers of any system. But in particular, we've got a system right now that really incentivizes people to go to very expensive graduate degrees. And that's logical. That's a good thing. We need highly educated public servants and people in the private sector that are doing great work for the public. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that our current system, one of the big costs of a complex student loan system is you have more inequality, not less inequality. That's a similar kind of setup to the tax code. If you have a complicated tax code, people that have access to more resources are going to hire better tax folks, and they're going to get a lower tax rate compared to somebody that can't access that same help. You know, and even people that can access that help too, right? If you're, you know, a lot of the places you might have seen, if you drive around lower income neighborhoods, you'll see a lot of tax centers in those neighborhoods. Why? It's because a lot of lower income Americans get a lot of their cash savings from the earned income tax credit, which is refundable. And so a lot of the tax prep firms will set up shop in lower income neighborhoods, and they'll have a model of charging a percent of someone's refund for that earned income tax credit that they get back as a share of that. And so that person's losing, you know, a large percent of the refund that they're getting, whereas somebody who's higher income might not lose as high a percent of their tax refund or their tax savings. Now, you might say this is the case for a lot of things in society, and that might be true, but it's just pretty interesting to think about this being one of the big costs. You know, another example of inequality that we can think about with the current student loan system is think about the case of physicians. If you said, where do we need physicians the most? You'd probably say in underserved urban environments or underserved rural environments for primary care specialties especially. And that makes sense. Primary care earns less. Certainly, there's a big burden on primary care doctors to serve patients when in very challenging environments. I would say my wife as a specialist also has a big burden, but it's just not as much of a shortage of subspecialists as there are primary care, especially in these rural and underserved urban environments. But if you think about the PSLF program, what does it reward? It rewards the subspecialists. So if you go to a long fellowship, you're able to pay $200 or $300 a month. You will only have to pay as a subspecialist income-based payments as an attending for maybe the final 2 years, really, of your 10 years for PSLF. Meanwhile, somebody who's a primary care doctor has to make those attending-level payments possibly as soon as 3 or 4 years into their post-medical school life because their training is so much shorter. They make that attending income sooner. So in a lot of cases, a primary care physician is going to pay more money on their loans than a subspecialist might, despite the subspecialist might maybe earning 2 or 3 times the income of the primary care doctor where there's a shortage. So that's like kind of fundamentally a inefficient allocation of resources in society. If you're trying to get more, you need more physicians, period, right? So I'm not saying that subspecialists aren't deserving. What I'm simply saying is if you're saying, how do you get the most bang for your buck for what society needs the most? Well, you would want to sort of incentivize primary care doctors more than you'd want to incentivize subspecialists because of that lower ROI that the primary care doctors are getting on their education. But we're doing the opposite, and it's increasing inequality. So it's a little bit of food for thought. That's the first of 5 big costs of complex student loan policy. The second big cost is uncertainty. How many of you with student loans being paused have been happy about it? Certainly a lot of you, right? Especially if you do not have private student loans and you didn't refinance, you're feeling pretty good about a 2.5 year plus pause on student loan interest and payments. But at the same token, have you ever felt uncertainty or just anxiety about the fact that they have been paused and what happens when they eventually turn them back on again? A lot of people have expressed to us that they're sort of feeling like there's like this kind of rock hanging over their head that could get dropped at any moment. And it's nice to have that relief, but people know that the relief is temporary and people just don't know how to plan for their future. They don't know how, if they can go buy that house they wanted to buy. They don't know if they can take the vacations they wanted to take. They don't know if they can take that new job that they were hoping to do. And ultimately, when you have something like the student loan pause, it's like taking ibuprofen. It's not fixing the actual problem. It's just relieving the symptoms. But if you know that that's eventually going to come back and you'll eventually be, I guess this is maybe a bad analogy, but you'll eventually be banned from taking ibuprofen, that's kind of a really anxiety-inducing feeling that that loan burden is going to come back. I saw somebody on Twitter post something like, hey, Joe, would be great to know with my apartment hunting if I'm going to have to plan for my $300 a month student loan payment. I'm pretty worried about it because I don't know if I can afford a 1-bedroom if I have to account for making student loan payments. This is a real problem. This is affecting people being able to plan for the future. It's affecting people being able to know what to do. There's no chance that they're talking about canceling really more than $10,000 based off of all the reports that I've seen. And so canceling $10,000 for a lot of people is really not going to do that much. The cost of bad student loan policy is certainly uncertainty about planning for the future is a big part of it. Next cost, number 3 on the list of 5 big costs of complex student loan policy, is the cost of short-term fixes. there are no, there's not good blood in Congress right now, right? There's bad blood between the two parties. They can't really agree on much of anything. When they do agree on something, it might seem like it's a great bipartisan compromise, but in effect, it's kind of just really surface level stuff, I think, like just things that are not particularly controversial. On really difficult, controversial items, the two parties are super far apart. Here's one example. The Democrats recently proposed that PSLF be a five-year program instead of a 10-year program, which would dramatically speed up the time that somebody needs to get their loans discharged. The Republicans recently proposed eliminating PSLF altogether. If you're thinking about how far apart the two parties are, neither one of them agree that the status quo is okay. But the problem is the status quo difference is just miles apart. When you're talking about, hey, maybe we should eliminate it versus let's make it twice as generous, that's a pretty big chasm about what you should do with loans. If you look at the Republicans' proposal for a new single IBR plan, both parties very much agree that there should be one IBR plan because the numerous number of repayment plans is very confusing to people. But what's ended up happening is I think the Democrats are getting ready to release the new IBR plan, which, you know, I'm recording this. They might release it the second after I record this. If so, we'll do an emergency pod about it. But it's probably going to be more generous than most of the repayment plans that exist. The Republicans want to make a plan that's less generous than all of the repayment plans that exist. Now, in some ways, it might be more generous, but here's the differences. So the Democrats' kind of initial plan would probably increase the percent of poverty line you can deduct before they take a percent of your loans. They might create a marginal repayment structure where you might only pay 5% of your income up to a certain percent of the poverty line after your percent of your poverty line gets deducted. So it would probably significantly reduce most people's payments. The question is who will they include? Who will they exclude? Will they include spouses or exclude spouses? Those kind of things are pretty relevant. For the Republicans' IBR plan, their plan would basically make you pay until you've paid back the principal and interest that you would have paid on your 10-year plan. So let's just say you borrowed $400,000, principal plus interest over 10 years would be $500,000. You would literally have to pay until you've satisfied $500,000 of principal and interest, and it wouldn't be time-based anymore like the current plans are that you get forgiveness after 20 years or 25 years, for example. Now, they would say that if you have paid back principal and interest already, that they would eliminate your loans, which is something that's unique and new and novel. They've also talked about having a cap on overall interest where if your interest is negatively amortizing past the point of you having paid back your, you know, your principal and interest total amount, they would stop that interest accrual, which is also an interesting idea. But the IBR plans, again, are so far apart based off of what Congress thinks that they should do. You know, again, sort of Democrats saying it should be even more generous, Republicans saying it should be less generous. So what does that create? That creates an incentive for the executive branch to come in and, you know, change things and take away or add programs haphazardly. So why is the PSLF waiver and IDR waiver like it is? It's because they were trying to avoid legal risks, upsetting privately held FFEL loan investors that would have been, you know, very upset if they had just started forgiving debt right and left without consolidating it first and paying them all back. So that's why you have to consolidate in many cases to get the benefits of these waivers because of legal reasons with these investors that own these sort of privately held but federally backed loans. What that does is it just makes a lot of weird things happen, right? It's just a lot of weird, complicated rules that people with fewer resources have a harder time accessing. So what do you do? You know, you have this new IBR plan that was passed in Congress as part of the ACA, but it was only slated to take effect for people that are new borrowers as of 2014. That's what the new IBR plan says. Well, President Obama wanted to create a plan that got people access to lower payments sooner because he was up for re-election in 2012. So he had made it a speech to the University of Iowa and wanted the people in that crowd to be able to get access to better repayment terms. And so they used the power of executive action to come up with a new plan called Pay As You Earn that was far more generous than the 15% of your income for 25 years that IBR was set at. And then they came up with yet another repayment plan off the concern that too much of those benefits for Pay As You Earn were going to high income borrowers and high debt borrowers. So they created revised Pay As You Earn in part to make it clear that they wanted to have more benefits go to like lower income people, but also to provide some level of interest subsidy for folks as well because of concerns about interest ballooning. But that's how you have extra repayment plans. That's how you went from ICR to IBR, to pay as you earn, to repay, to now Biden's new plan, whatever it's going to be. The reason why you have five income-based, soon to be five income-based repayment plans instead of one, is because of short-term fixes, because of the incentive structure of Congress not being able to agree on anything, then the administration coming in and doing things that they want to do. But the problem is executive actions are restricted by what's in the statute. So you can't go like and ignore what's in the actual law. You have to work around the law. And that creates all these really weird things. Like if you were a borrower as of this date, or if you were a, you know, if you took out these kind of loans, or if you consolidated, right? This is mostly because of executive actions being restricted by what you can do in the law. And it's a very inefficient way to do things. And it creates a lot of confusion, and it creates a bunch of extra complexity when you do things this way. So that's the third cost of the complex student loan policies that exist. The fourth cost is just the absolute cost level. I have been on the record saying that the modeling for the costs of student loans is really awful. This is partly a function of, I think, like the Congressional Budget Office and people that model this stuff. They're incredibly smart, a lot smarter than me. I think the only reason why they are so bad at modeling the student loan system is they're not at all like thinking big picture and in terms of what behavioral changes will happen when certain things occur. What I mean by that is if you have a $1.7 trillion loan portfolio, half of which is held by like a relatively smaller group of borrowers, the right that went to graduate schools and things like that, and you take IBR and you make a much more generous version of IBR, what they tend to not do is make any assumptions about how everybody's going to switch to that new IBR plan, which is way more costly and results in way bigger forgiveness. If you do something like PSLF, rather than actually try to model how many people will get PSLF, they'll like throw up their hands and just say, well, it's more than 10 years out for the most part, so we're not going to spend a bunch of time modeling it. For the waiver programs, they tend to do things that to me are absolutely incredulous. Like they'll assume that there's no cost at all to pausing income-based repayment plans. I still don't understand this. If anybody's a modeling expert or works at one of these places, please feel free to contact me. The current like modeling of the student loan pause is that pausing income-based repayment is essentially free because people will pay more in interest because they're pausing their income-based repayments. And so they'll pay that interest back later, which offsets the paused payments from people that are getting credit for forgiveness during this time. Part of that is because people don't understand how many people are going to go for forgiveness. It's going to be a ton of people going for forgiveness. And any of the payments that are paused right now, they're accounting for forgiveness for people that the 9 million people that are on IBR. I guess maybe about half of those people would be making payments of close to zero anyway. But the other half would are you know, and probably a lot of maybe you listening to this, you're saving $1,000 a month or $1,500 a month or maybe even $5,000 a month if you're a very high income public servant like you're a surgeon or something at a teaching hospital. That is a very large cost that they're not modeling at all. So in terms of the cost of things, you know, you might say, well, they paused student loans for 2.5 years and the economy's been just fine. That's true. I mean, if you think about student loans in the grand scheme of things, student loan costs in terms of what the government spends money on is pretty small, all things considered. You know, supposedly costs around like $40 to $50 billion a year to pause student loans. I think it costs more than that because of the like IBR credit that people are getting. But say it does cost like $50 billion, that's really cheap. Like Department of Defense is like $700 billion. I think Social Security and Medicare is in the trillions, $1 or $2 trillion. So pausing student loans, is that expensive? Sure, but it's really not that expensive in the grand scheme of things. That said, it's still money that ends up getting spent on one thing that might be able to be spent on something else. And so if you're thinking about like what is one of the big costs of complex student loans, when you have a really complex loan policy, it's really difficult for policymakers to understand the trade-offs of what they are spending. So for example, the Government Accountability Office recently came out with a study and they found that the government, instead of earning money on student loans, is projected to lose money on student loans. You know, it was projected in the past that the GAO, the Department of Ed, thought that they were going to make a profit of $114 billion over like 25 years or something like that on student loans. Instead of making that profit, they're actually now projecting $197 billion loss. And they put out in that report that this does not include the costs of future administrative actions the Biden administration is considering, like the PSLF waiver, like the IDR waiver, like canceling student debt. when you have a complex loan system, it's not clear as to what you're spending. What would be a much better system, I think, is if you're just increasing Pell Grants, literally just making the indirect grants that are happening through student loan forgiveness more direct, where you're actually having to pay for that and you're clear as to what you are paying and you're understanding a little bit more as to what the trade-offs are. Like if you're having to raise taxes or reduce spending in other areas, what we're doing right now is just sort of like financing it through the deficit. And it's kind of confusing as to what the trade-offs are long-term. It's going to be really interesting. I think student loans will be never nearly as big as the biggest expenses, like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid will always be so much bigger than student loans. So it is a relatively minor thing compared to a lot of the stuff government spends money on, but it would be helpful for taxpayers and, you know, Congress making the budget to have a better view as to what the student loan system does actually cost. Because if you are actually losing money, then maybe it does make sense to transition some of these loan programs to grant programs, right? Because you're spending the money anyway. Something to think about. Fifth big cost of the complex student loan system is the harm to upward mobility. If you're thinking about people that are first generation or from disadvantaged groups or from communities of color that might not have had the same access to education historically that other people have had, having a very clear path towards getting more education and advancing in your career is important. And when you create loan rules that are super complicated and difficult to understand, and it's not really transparent and clear as to what exactly you're signing up for when you decide to make the educational decision of going to a school, that dissuades people from taking investments in themselves and doing these investments in themselves. What do I mean by that? Think about med school. If you understood that you could go to med school and effectively pay maybe $50,000 on your loans through the PSLF program, how many more people from less advantaged groups would be interested in going to med school? I think a lot more people. How many people that might otherwise say, well, maybe I'll just stop at being like a, you know, a medical assistant or something, right? Or maybe I'll just stop at being a, and this is, by the way, not at all putting down that work. What I'm saying is, you know, and as an individual, what do you want to do? I think a lot of people look at the costs of something and they think it's so high that they decide to not make that investment of getting that terminal degree. I think that does happen. And I think that probably disproportionately happens to people from lower income families than higher income families. I think that's probably a fair statement. So at an individual level, are people making all the educational investments that they could make in themselves based off of realizing that the loan forgiveness rules are so generous? When you have a complex student loan system, it makes it very difficult to understand what the true costs are. Folks that understand this, like we have a pre-debt consult, for example, people that get that consult, they walk away knowing, wow, I should probably be borrowing the maximum for living expenses, even if I can afford to pay cash, because I'm going for loan forgiveness anyway. And you might say, well, that's not ethical. Well, it is, because that's just what the rules of the system encourage. Is it ethical to create a pass-through entity for taxes? Is it ethical to do a pre-tax 401k and then take tax-deductible RMDs and distribute them to charity and pay nothing for taxes? Is it ethical to take the step up in basis when you die and pass your assets to your heirs and not pay any estate taxes because of good tax planning? I don't think that issue is an ethical issue. It's more about, based off of the rules that exist, what is the smart thing to do based on the rules that exist? In other words, comply with the laws that our democracy has come up with, but don't pay extra just to pay extra, because that's not, you know, a smart way to do finances. I do think that upward mobility is a big cost of having a complex student loan system. If we're ultimately spending tens of billions of dollars a year anyway on student loans, it probably would be smart to take some of that and allocate it more towards grants and allow people to have a more clear path towards understanding, how do I become a veterinarian or a dentist or a physician, and how do I get that terminal degree for my family and for my future? Complex loan rules definitely confuse people. It makes it difficult for policymakers to make trade-offs. It is difficult for the short-term fixes that happen with these different income-based repayment plans. It creates uncertainty and it can increase inequality. So that might be a little bit too depressing of a podcast for a summer, week in the summer. So hopefully you're listening to this and thinking, wow, there's so much broken with this system. And I think there's two ways to respond to this. You can say, throw your hands up. This is just a terrible system. Why does it exist this way? You just get paralyzed by cynicism. I don't think that's a good approach to do, right? I think that eventually things work out. I think that this broken loan system will eventually be reformed. It will probably take several years or maybe even decades to get reformed. Eventually, the costs will be reined in for these institutions. But these things are going to happen over a long enough period of time that it is probably not productive use of your time to worry about any of it. One thing I'll say is recent reform proposals, such as the Republican proposal in the House, carve out the ability for people to use existing loan programs and get the forgiveness that you have offered to you in your promissory notes. So this kind of stuff is something that you will be able to get benefits from under the current loan rules, get these loans out of your life, treating them like an income tax or paying them down aggressively if that makes more sense. And then just focusing on the bigger, more important things in life, like your goals, your dreams. And I think when we're talking about canceling student debt or making a new income-based plan or how much loans to offer people versus grants, I do hope that one thing that long-term is looked at is simplicity in the loan rules. But if you look at other things in society, our messy democracy kind of encourages complexity for a lot of different reasons. And I think it's probably unlikely that's going to change. I will say, not to just focus on the negatives of the student loan system, I will say one of the big benefits of the loan system is the current makeup of professional groups is far more diverse now than it was in the past. A lot more people have options to these careers that never had options before, because frankly, you're going to get maybe discriminated against if you don't have access to credit. If you want to go become a physician with the current loan system, you can do that. And prior iterations of these policies, maybe you couldn't. Same thing for a lot of professions. The Parent Plus loan system, if you did not have access to private student loans past the Stafford loan limits, previously you were not able to send your kids to the institution you wanted to send them to. Now you are able to send them to the institution you want to send them to, and you probably need to do a super complicated, silly doubled consolidation to be able to make ends meet because they block you from accessing it directly. So there's all kinds of stuff that probably should be different about the loan rules, but it isn't. And so therefore, just accept what you cannot change. Get a plan to eliminate the stress from your life and just encourage your elected officials, people around you, policymakers to make things simpler, which would be, I guess, against our economic best interests. But I think that probably most CPAs would tell you they wish taxes were a little simpler too, because it would just be a lot more better for society. And, given that they probably won't make it easier, maybe even then they might make it more complicated is really what's happened in the past year. I think that's why our consult bookings, frankly, have tripled in the past year and a half, is not just because we hopefully do a really good job for people, but it's because they're making the loan rules even more complicated, which increases the savings we can find people. One last point, we are booked for August now completely and are booking into September. I think that things are going to get really busy as we come up at the end of the PSLF waiver. Definitely try to book in September if you're a public servant, if you can, especially, just because that'll give us time to do needed consolidations if they are necessary, and then also to submit the PSLF waiver forms without having to do them both at the same time, which can run the risk of messing things up a little bit, even though it probably is fine. It's just nice to be able to do the consolidations first and then submit the ECF forms, if possible, if we have time. In October, we're going to be telling everybody to just submit them both at the same time. It's going to be a race against the clock if they don't extend the waiver. Maybe they will, within a few weeks or a couple days, I'm not sure. But it would kind of make sense if they extended the waivers until the end of the IDR waiver and until they start repayment again. But boy, oh boy, is it going to be nuts. So buckle up, get ready. Obviously, if you need a plan, studentloanplanner.com/book. If you have any questions, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail and just record a few questions. But if you have any questions about what the new IBR plan might look like, about how the waivers are being processed, any kind of loan transfers, and I hope you enjoy the last few weeks of summer. Look forward to your questions on the voicemail line. Thank you, everybody, for listening.